It's in the studio tonight, a founding members of the Sydney-based group Takadimi. With a world of styles at their disposal, Takadimi exerts a genuine obsession for the possibilities within genres and their indefinite boundaries. The group bring you into their worlds through inventive improvisations and evocative soundscapes with influences from the likes of Esbjorn Svensson's trio, Jan Garbarek, John Butler, Tomasz Stanko, Bela Fleck and Jean-Luc Ponty. Guitarist Kieran Ryan Colton and violinist Brianne Curran, welcome to Now's the Time.
Hi.
Hi, Frank.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Can I start by asking you about how you came to discover music and how you gravitated towards your respective instruments? Can we start with yourself, Brianne?
I started when I was three, so I don't really think I chose that at that stage. My brother and sister both played, so music was just a part of our lives, and our neighbours, their children all played as well, and our violin teacher taught up the road from us. We used to walk to violin lessons. It took us 2 minutes. It was at my preschool at the time.
So one of those miniature violins?
Yeah. I don't even know what I started on. I remember, like, tissue boxes and rulers and rubber bands. Yeah, but then I just kind of kept with it because it was just something that we all did, you know, in summer with holidays we used to just go to violin camps and was just, you know, just part of the family and part of our lives. And later on I had a really inspiring teacher who did folk music, so I did classical pretty much all, you know, my upbringing until I was about 17.
You mentioned you go on camps, and I think that's quite important to know that you're part of a community that play the violin rather than sort of the odd men out at school, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I'd say most of my good friends were not at school. I'd have my orchestra friends and I'd be really excited about going to orchestra after school and hang out with them, and then we'd go on those camps, and then I did Suzuki music as well and we'd go on those camps. And I mean, even now I teach with a friend that we played violin together and went on those camps in Tamworth and other, you know, Adelaide and stuff together. So yeah, there's a bit of a community out there for those people that don't know about that.
Lots of music in the house when you were growing up?
Oh yeah, yeah. I was a middle child. I knew pieces, you know, but just from hearing my brother play them all the time. And even now, there might be some classical piece because he went to the con and did classical music. But then I went and did like folk music and jazz or contemporary improvised stuff. And but there'll be songs that he was practicing for uni even, and I'll have never played it before, but somehow someone will play it and I'll just know every note for note just because of him practicing so much. So
what about yourself, Kieran?
Both my parents are musicians. My mum, she's a viola player. She plays a lot of Celtic Irish music stuff and classical stuff. And my dad, he's a guitarist. He's a jazz guitarist. So he was pretty active in Sydney back in the 80s and 90s. He was playing with James Morrison and Grace Knight and those types of people.
Dave Colton.
Yeah. He left. My mum and dad split up when I was four. So he kind of left the house. So I wasn't too influenced by his guitar playing until I've spent some time with him. He lives in London now. I've been over there and spent some time with him and tried to learn some of his licks. Yeah, it was interesting, actually. We tend to sort of have developed a similar style, even though we didn't really have much interaction as growing up. I didn't really hang out with him much, or I didn't learn guitar from him at all.
But
we've developed a similar sort of taste. And
you'd have access to some of his recordings though?
Yeah, a few, not too many. Yeah, so I picked up the drums first, actually, and then picked up the guitar and went through school doing that. Yeah, then went to the Australian Institute of Music and studied there for 3 years. And
Takadimi's been touring a little.
Brianne's been pretty, she's been pretty active on the management side of things, which I've realised is a big part of getting a band together and getting opportunities.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the term world music.
Neither.
On Tuesday, I was driving home and listening to the radio, and I was listening to the Hot Club of France on the radio with Stefan Grappelli and Django Reinhardt, thinking to myself, their music may have been the first genuine collision that jazz had with another established genre. Much of your music comes from this kind of idea, does it not?
Yeah, well, I don't think there's too much of an idea behind our, like, there's not like we have a concept of, yeah, okay, we're going to mesh jazz with these styles of music. I guess from our influences, we've just been exposed to a lot of different music and enjoyed a lot of different music. And through our writing and compositional things, it just sort of naturally happens where we'll take certain aspects from different music .
And there's a lot of variety in these tunes on this album, New Common Sense, your debut.
Part of that is because compositions were written by all of this. There's not just one composer. So there's five people coming up with their ideas. And
so how did the group come together?
Well, we all met at the Institute of Music. We all studied there. And we all just had a sort of bit of an affinity with each other and a similar interest in the music. A lot of the musicians there are quite contemporary rock, pop musicians. And I guess we had sort of more of a inclination towards jazz and folk music and more, I guess, not subtler music, because jazz can be very unsubtle. But and you can, in a lot of ways, choose your own direction at that place. You can, go to a certain teacher who is quite esteemed at jazz, or go to a teacher who's more esteemed at being a session pop dude playing in theatres or being sort of more of an acoustic guitarist. So it's good for that.
Now, how long has the group been together? This is your debut, New Common Sense.
We've been together since, yes, you guys, like some of the other guys met at AIM in 2007, and I kind of came there in 2008, and I think that was when we first kind of started there. It was just put together for a project for one of our classes where we have to make, put a performance on. We decided to go to the National Folk Festival in 2009, and we were having a rehearsal to get songs together for that at our friend's place, and Kieran was there. And I actually said to Kieran, oh, you should come along, but I wasn't actually meaning to come and play with us. And then I felt a little bit shy, and because he was so excited, I thought, to come and play, and I couldn't say no. And I'm still here.
This is the first I've heard of this.
Therese, why this track, and can you tell us a little bit about it?
This track was written by our other guitarist in the band, James McKendry, and it's got a feel sort of like a samba feel, and he wrote it. He's always a bit vague. He's never really expressed what he really wrote it about, but he's a big nature lover, and I think it's got something to do with that. A bit of a play on words, Therese and trees.
Right. Okay.
So yeah.
Gotcha. Theresa Green.
Yeah.
Now, Briaren, you composed 5 of the 10 pieces for this debut release. Does composing music come easy to you?
The thing that kind of melds it together is that, like, we have individuals that compose the pieces, but then we'll bring them to the table and we'll, like, to the rehearsal, and then we'll all kind of put our bits and pieces of ideas into the songs and all arrange it together, which I guess is where that kind of continuity comes and that sort of sound that we are trying to create together and comes from. So it's kind of like, is like the, you know, cliche word of melting pot, sort of, you know, between the five of us in our, you know, little rehearsal space. Coming up with ideas and just bouncing them off each other to create something else out of what, you know, one of us has kind of brought in. And sometimes it's a small little idea, you know, maybe it's just a melody, like a little folk melody, and then out of that we kind of get these weird sort of sections, like someone's like, oh, well, let's put these hits in there, or let's have this key change here, or let's put these chords here. I've got this cool idea of how to, like, deal with that situation of how to get from, like, A to B or something. And that's where it kind of gets really fun and experimental and explorative and kind of, I guess, tests ourselves sometimes as well.
And does it test your ability then to translate that into a live situation?
Yeah, I mean,
in front of an audience?
I guess for us, the way we recorded the album is, like, most of it's live takes because we work better like that. That's the music, because there is a lot of room for improvisation. There's also a lot of structure to it as well. So there's a lot of stuff that we'll play it similar to you know, how it's on the recording, but then in those other spaces we'll mix and match, or, you know, in Gone Swimming, which is on the album, now we've kind of decided to put a reggae section in there, you know. And we did a gig, part of this thing called Train Tracks, where you have, like, just bands and DJs and things on public transport. They had one last week which was pretty incredible, and they turned in one of the train carriages going from the city to the North Shore into an art gallery.
They turned the Manly Ferry into a bit of a nightclub.
Yeah, we did a gig for them, and it was on Manly Beach in, I think, February it was, and had these bubble machines. And
you've talked about, you know, your interest in composing for film, haven't you?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, I like it's something that I'm interested in, and I have ideas. You know, if I want to sit down, usually it's just, you know, I have a feeling or just to, you know, explore some sort of idea, or maybe I just have all these different sounds in my head and I just want to put them on the paper. But I mean, each of the songs that I wrote, they come from a space. Like Into the Night and Gone Swimming were the first songs that kind of were written for the group, and things started to kind of come from that, I don't know, momentum of composing. And I wrote those when I was in the Blue Mountains living up there. I just come back from the National Folk Festival, which was really cool because I kind of hadn't been to it for a while after being into folk music for a long time, because I'd gone to jazz school and I was like, oh, the folks thing, you know, that's like simple stuff, or, you know, whatever. Like, and I just was enjoying the simplicity of it, and that just that heart, you know, it's just this earthy sort of thing, and people just sit around and play tunes and it's nice and they enjoy it, and not trying to show off. They're just, not that I'm not saying like jazz is cool. It's, you know, I'd love to play it better, but I was just enjoying that it was simple and, you know, people-based. And
now, that's the composition side of it, but what about the audience side of it and the art of engagement with the audience? How do you go about that? Because you're concentrating so much on the music.
Mm. And, we don't do that. No. But, yeah, I mean, I guess every band has got their ways that they can engage. Some Rammstein, you know, they have huge fireworks and phalluses and... And other bands, you know, do it other ways. I think for our music, it's got to be in a way that the audience can kind of go into our world that we're creating and sort of, I guess, a bit of escapism in that sense. So we can create a kind of bubble of unreality and people can hop into it and float away.
Now, when you're talking about hopping into it, the name of your group, Takadimi. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, that comes from the name of the system to read rhythms like a language would be taught.
Mm.
Much of your music is driven rhythmically. Do you find your audiences get the urge to dance?
Well, we have certain tunes that are pretty dancey. You know, we've got tunes that are kind of based on some African kind of Ethiopian rhythms or some samba rhythms. But then we've got some tunes that are a bit more, you know, folky tunes just based on a sort of slow melody, and maybe people... you know, kind of swoon away the night, just kind of sway and with their lover or something to that music. But I wouldn't say we're a dance band. But yeah, sure, if you want to get up and do some sort of contemporary interpretive dancing to some of our slower tunes, we're all for that.
Just before we get off the name there, just explain to our listeners that may not be aware of the Takadimi system.
Can we give a...
Do you want to give an example?
Takadimi.
Yeah. So it's a rhythmic counting system in Indian classical music.
How often do you think you hit that sweet spot in your music? How do you feel when you get to that, and how often do you think that happens?
With us, like we've talked about earlier, with changing members and such, it can be a bit hard because, you know, people are... It's new music, and they're just trying to make it work first before they can access that place you're talking about. But it does happen, and when it does happen, it really takes the performance somewhere else, and it provides the reason why you do original music. Because for me, I don't get that feeling from doing cover gigs or anything like that. Yeah, the feeling of creating this, and yeah, it's sort of got something a bit cosmic about it or something like that, that, you know, I think it's a truthful thing that everyone in the room can sort of get. You know, when it's happening, it's real. The band gets it. I'm pretty sure the audience is feeling that as well. So, yeah, there is, I mean, for me, that's one of the most special things about live performance. It's this indescribable event when that special thing happens that, yeah, like me trying to explain it and talk about it now can't really do it justice. I kind of see it as, you know, a good way to exercise the other part of my brain, you know, like more of a practical, logical part of my brain of, okay, this is a craft, and how am I going to, you know, work on this craft and improve my craft in this framework, in this area. And, you know, like for me, there's always something I can get out of it. And mainly, there's the thing that I can always get out of any gig is a groove or a rhythm. I might not necessarily get inspired by the harmony in a cover band gig, so if it's 1-4-5 harmony, but there's all, like, rhythm can always, even a 4-4 groove can still, you know, you can still really get so into that and really try and make it feel so good. And yeah, so for me, even on gigs that aren't too inspiring in terms of the lyrical, harmonic or melodic content, the rhythm can still be a big, a big thing that keeps me interested.
It's interesting, I asked Mike Nock in an interview a few years ago, and he said when he's, you know, he obviously did those gigs when he was coming through in the 60s as well, gigs that he may not have normally done, but he said at some point in the early 1970s, he just stopped doing those gigs.
Right.
And nothing changed from a financial perspective or, you know, the only thing that changed, that he was now fully focused on his own music and he was still able to continue. I know it's different times. I noticed your album's independently released, and there's no evidence on the cover that you receive any government support in relation to the album. In light of George Brandis's recent comments, what's your philosophy on government support for the arts?
I mean, I'm not too au fait with the studies of how arts affect society, but I would assume that they have a really positive effect. So if the government takes that into account and their job is to support a prosperous society and community, then yeah, helping artists bring art to that society would seems like a practical way to improve society. And
I just think in my times that I've gone to Melbourne, I've been going to the Australasian Worldwide Music Expo the last 2 years, like a week-long thing where they have a lot of the best musicians from around the world playing music and a lot of the, like, festival bookers and things, but also a lot of the public come along and see the shows, and, you know, the minister from the arts come, and, you know, just the start of the whole thing, they're just acknowledging the Aboriginals, but not just like a quick sort of welcome, it's like a big thing, and they have like this show, and it's really nice, and you start to, like, I feel kind of, you know, closer to that culture that, you know, and I should feel that. And I just thought that was just amazing. And then just even walking around Melbourne at night time, I feel a lot more comfortable down there. Maybe not in all the parts, but it just in general. And I just feel in the air, there's just, you know, just with the art and there's lots more buskers on the streets. And I don't know, just people just seem to be, I don't know what it is. Like, people feel like they'll go to gigs there. Like, in Sydney, sometimes I feel there's just this stale sort of energy, and there's more alcohol, and there's more about the pokies, and I don't know, it could just be like my honeymoon phase with Melbourne. I don't live there, of course, but, you know, I don't live there, and I just have this nice kind of rose-coloured glasses vision of the place. But just seeing that, you know, I feel arts are more supported at the moment in Melbourne than just comparing the two cities.
Art is kind of, sometimes it's hard to, you know, put the benefits of it into statistics. Sometimes art can be quite abstract. You can't really quantify it.
It's not tangible.
Yeah, it's not tangible. So a government, they might look at it and, you know, think, oh, we'll give our money to something that is more obvious and more tangible, and we can, you know, do statistics about it and prove that it is doing some good. So then it can help in our next election campaign. We can show you the statistics. But giving it to art, it's kind of hard. Sometimes it can't help their portfolio or something, so they might, you know, they might not be willing to do it.
What plans have you got for the group Takadini in the future?
If you're talking 60 years in the future, maybe just, you know, living out in a cabin. But in the near future, we haven't recorded an album for a couple of years, and we've got a whole bunch of new tunes. So this year is sort of like a lead up to recording at the end of the year, and probably doing it in a bit of a different way. This last record, we did it over 3 days, just, you know, banged it out down in this cabin down near the Southern Highlands, and there wasn't too much post-production or pre-production. So this time it's going to be probably a more drawn-out affair, where we sort of, and hopefully we can add like a layered aspect to it, you know, like bring in percussion and things like that, and overdubbing and a bit less of a live thing. Like, still have essentially live tracks, but then dress them up in a bit of frills.
Mm-hmm. Mm. That's Takadimi. Thanks very much for joining us, Kieran, Ryan Colton, and Brianne Curran.
Thanks
for having us.